It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam. Putnam is the author of 14 books translated into 20 languages, including the best-selling Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. In it, Putnam argues that civic life in the U.S. is declining with some ominous consequences. His writings are among the most cited publications in the social sciences worldwide in the last half century. Putnam consults widely with national leaders, including the last three American presidents, also the last three British prime ministers, and the last French president. Putnam's latest book, published in the spring of 2015, is called Our Kids. And in this book, he identifies the widening opportunity gaps created by the growing inequality income among Americans. The diminishing life chances of lower-class families are put in sharp contrast to the expanding resources of the upper class. And his latest book also includes suggestions of what we as a nation should do about this trend. Bob Putnam, welcome to our program.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be talking with you, Ben.
Should also mention you're the Malkin Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. This Friday, you'll be speaking at a sold-out event at Drake University in Des Moines at Drake University's Harkin Institute. And I understand, Bob, you'll also be leading a coffee hour discussion about the growing inequality in American society in the morning on Friday.
That's right.
Let's talk about your latest book that will be the focus of your visit and your talk. In Our Kids, you address this state of upward mobility in our country and argue that widening income gaps have brought some profound changes to family life, to neighborhoods, to our schools, and that have a significant impact on upward mobility. Explain what you see happening.
Well, Ben, let's go back to the beginning. At the very beginning of our country, we had this idea that all kids, regardless of their family background, ought to get a decent chance of success in life. That's the American dream. We said all men are created equal. Of course, at the time, we meant men, and we didn't mean all men. We meant white men. But over time, that basic promise that how well you do in life should depend upon your own God-given talents and gifts and how hard you work, but not on what your parents did or didn't do. And the research that is incorporated in this new book called Our Kids shows that over the last 30 years or so in America, an opportunity gap has opened up widely between kids coming from affluent backgrounds and kids coming from poor backgrounds. And when I say affluent, I don't just mean Bill Gates' kids. I mean kids coming from college-educated homes, those kids are doing pretty well nowadays, better in some cases than kids like them used to. But on the very same measures of resources and success and opportunity, kids coming from impoverished backgrounds are doing worse and worse. And again, by impoverished, I don't just mean homeless kids. I mean kids coming from what we used to call the working class. That opportunity gap is the focus of this book.
So make a distinction here. We've always had the rich kids and the poor kids, rich and poor cities, areas sure. of the nation, rich and poor school districts. What makes our time different for kids?
Well, the evidence that it's different is shown in the book in a series of what we call scissors graphs. That is, charts that show how things have been changing over the last 30 years between kids coming from high school educated homes and kids coming from college educated homes. I mean, when I say high school educated homes, that's the lower third of American society. That's what we used to call the working class. And the differences between their situation and the situation of kids coming from the upper third of American society, college educated, show up in things like how stable their families are, and of kids all across America coming from relatively affluent families. 92% of them are living in two-parent families, as opposed to about 30 or 35% of kids coming from what we used to call working-class families. That is, let me underline that, two-thirds of kids of all races coming from working-class families now are living with a single parent. So there's a big, and that didn't used to be the case. It didn't used to be the case that there was that big gap in family stability. There's a similar or parallel gap that's opened up in terms of how much money Parents can invest in their kids. It's now, that is, for things like summer camp and piano lessons and computer games and trips to the zoo and so on, all those things, there's been a sharp rise in the amount of what we're calling summer camp money for kids coming from affluent backgrounds, but not among kids coming from poor backgrounds. So there's a summer camp gap. There's also what we call a goodnight moon gap, a growing goodnight moon gap. That is, in the amount of time that parents spend reading to their kids and playing with their kids and so on. Again, it used to be there were no class differences in that, mm-hmm. but now upper-class kids get 45 minutes a day more time of what we call goodnight moon time. So there are similar gaps in the quality of school, growing gaps, that's the point, in the quality of schools kids attend. Upper-class kids are increasingly attending affluent high schools or elementary and high schools, and lower class kids are increasingly concentrated in schools with other lower class kids, and therefore they're schools that are plagued by gang violence and so on. There's a growing class gap in test scores, in how much education kids complete, in how much mentoring and other community support they get. For example, there's a growing class gap in just taking part in extracurricular activities. So there are these really daunting, no matter where you look, daunting increases in the resources and opportunities that are available to kids coming from well-off homes and the same kinds of opportunities that are not available to kids coming from poor homes.
So Bob Putnam, tell us, when did this start? What are the roots of we've had a division? Of course, it's always been divisions, but now you've talked about the way this division and this widening gap is different than previous inequities between rich and poor kids and families. When did this start, and what is driving it?
It started, roughly speaking, 30 or 40 years ago. You can see the beginnings of this opening up of this gap in the 1970s and 1980s. It's caused by, I think, a confluence of three big things that have happened, and then underlying that is an even bigger thing, which I'll mention quickly. The first cause is increasingly unequal distribution of income among parents. This is what's been talked about a lot before. We've talked about this in the country over the last 4 or 5 years or so, the fact that there's an increasing gap in the level, in the amount of income that the families have. Rich families increasingly have more income and poor families don't. So that's the first thing, how much money the parents have to spend on things like summer camp or better schools. That's the first big thing. It's not the only thing. A second is, and this is less widely recognized, America has become more segregated in terms of social class. We're not more segregated in all ways. We're more likely to live around or go to school with or even marry people from a different race or a different religion, but we're less likely than we used to live in near or around people from a different social class background or to go to school with them or even to marry people from a different class background. So we're increasingly living in enclaves, either rich enclaves or poor enclaves, and fewer of us are living in mixed or moderate income neighborhoods. That means, for example, that increasingly kids from affluent backgrounds are going to school only with other kids from affluent backgrounds, and the same thing is true for poor kids. They're increasingly going to school only with kids from other poor backgrounds. Another factor that's important, as I've said, is this collapse of the working class family. That began about 30 years ago. It began actually in the black community, which was the first to be hit by the economic crisis back in the 60s. But now the growth of family instability and single parent families and so on is concentrated nowadays among white families and white kids. So as I said before, 2/3 of kids growing up all across America of all races, two-thirds of the growing up in working-class families have only one parent. That obviously causes some problems. Obviously, there are a lot of single moms who are doing a terrific job, but it's just harder to raise kids with only one parent at home. When I was growing up in a small town in the Midwest, a small town in northern Ohio in the 1950s, town of 5,000 people, and when my parents used the term our kids, when they said, you know, we've got to pay higher taxes so that our kids can have a swimming pool at school or, you know, so we can have a French department in school. When they used the term our kids, they did not just mean my sister and me. They meant all the kids in town. And they kept, you know, voting for bond issues and so on long after my sister and I were gone. But over the last 30 or 40 years, all across America, the meaning of our kids has shriveled. So if you listen carefully, nowadays when people talk about doing things for our kids, they mean for their own biological kids. And if you talk to people in my hometown of Port Clinton nowadays about poor kids, and there are a lot more poor kids in Port Clinton now than there used to be. You know, you talk to most people in town, they say, well, they're not my kids, they're somebody else's kids. Let those other people worry about them. And that shriveling of our sense of responsibility for all the kids in town is, I think, the deepest underlying cultural cause here.
Bob Putnam is my guest, if you've just joined us, political scientist, the Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. His latest book, Our Kids, he's identifying the widening opportunity gaps created by growing inequality income among Americans. So many of our listeners, some of our listeners, let's say it that way, would react to what you're saying here, saying, you know, baby boomers saying, I grew up poor, my parents had little means, I made it. Young people should be able to do that today. Did you have that thought yourself at one time? How did that get changed?
Sure. The book Our Kids begins with the story of my own hometown, this little town called Port Clinton, Ohio. And I had that impression, and we went back and interviewed all of my – I graduated in the high school class of 1959, and we went back and interviewed all the surviving members of my high school graduating class, and we did remarkably well. 80% of us did better than our parents, and the kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks, as you might have said back then, did just about as well as the kids coming from the right side of the tracks. So that's fine. It was true back in the 50s and even into the 60s that we had a more or less, of course there were inequalities, and especially there were inequalities facing non-white kids, black kids in my hometown, and women encountered a glass ceiling in that year. I'm not trying to make that period sound, ideal, because there were racial and gender inequities. But in terms of social class, if people my age think, well, you know, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, why can't these kids today? They're right about what life used to be like. But that's the point I'm trying to make here. America has changed big time over the last 30 or 40 years, and it just isn't true now that the poor kids kids coming from poor backgrounds in Port Clinton have anything like the same opportunities that kids coming from comparable backgrounds 30 or 40 years ago did. The world has changed. American communities have changed. And there has been this growing class cleavage in America. And if you say nowadays to these poor kids in Port Clinton, well, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that isn't possible anymore, because these poor kids the kids coming from less affluent homes nowadays have been badly harmed by the fact that their parents either have not been able or have not done, in any end, haven't invested in them in anything like the same degree to which rich kids get invested in today by their parents.
Tie this into what we've been talking about for years is student debt. We have what was unheard of years ago, students going into debt by tens of thousands of dollars, so when their families, you know, they really can't afford it. How does that fit into this picture?
Well, look, it used to be, this is part of the same story, actually. It used to be that you could get a really first-class education at Ohio State or University of Iowa or Iowa State or University of California or University of Massachusetts, whatever. At any of these public institutions, you know, New York University, I mean, City University of New York, we provided low-cost public higher education for everybody. But nowadays, what's happened is that the public resources available to those public universities have been drastically cut back, and especially in the last decade or so. So the only way to get through Iowa or, you know, Berkeley or whatever now is tuition has gone way up, and that bill has been covered. The pullback of public money for public education has been covered by increasing debts for kids. you can see, in a strange way, you can see that same kind of thing happening in high schools all across America, in kids taking part in extracurricular activities. It used to be that almost all kids in high schools across America could take part for free in football or band or chorus or French club or you know, debate or whatever the activity was. Mm-hmm. But over the last 20 years, while participation rates have remained high and unchanging for kids coming from affluent homes, participation in all of those extracurricular activities has been plummeting among working-class kids. And you have to say, well, why did that happen? And the answer is pay-to-play. All across America in the last 20 years, school boards have adopted policies that say nowadays, if you want to, you know, play football or you want to in high school or you want to play in the band or whatever, your parents have to pay. And it's a lot of money. I mean, for the average kid in America who wants to play football, it's about, you know, or whatever, play in the band or chorus or something. On average, it's about $800 a year per child. So if you've got two kids in high school, and they both want to take part in some sport or music or art or whatever, that's $1,600 a year. Now, if your annual income is $200,000, $1,600 for your kids to play football is nothing. But if your annual income is $16,000, who in their right mind is going to be able to spend 10% of their total annual family income on your kids playing football? So that's been... there's been a collapse in working-class kids taking part in extracurricular activities. That matters because we know the evidence is quite clear. Taking part in extracurricular activities strengthens your what we nowadays call soft skills, your teamwork skills and teamwork and stick-to-itiveness and grit and all those things. And employers will pay people more, this is the fact, who have been able to take part in extracurricular activities. So you ask, how did that happen? We did this to ourselves. We started keeping kids, poor kids, from getting access to the same opportunities that rich kids have, and that's because we just cut back. I mean, when I was in high school, the good taxpayers of Port Clinton paid for my trombone and paid for 5 years of trombone lessons, and I was in football, and they paid for my spikes and my, you know, my pads and my helmet and the Friday night lights and all that. They did that for all the kids in town. And that's changed now. And if your parents don't have the money, you can't do those things. That's evil, frankly. I don't mean that the whole fate of America turns on extracurricular activities, but it's a nice example of how, by cutting back on public investments in all kids, we've disproportionately hurt poor kids.
Mm. Bob Putnam is my guest, political scientist at the Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. We're going to take a break, and we've got to a few minutes before we take a break, Bob. But I wanted to get, after you've laid out what has happened, why it's different than previous divides, and how this gap has been opening, and the implications of this gap, I wanted you to lay out what you see as a remedy and how important it is that action be taken sooner rather than later.
Well, let me answer the last question first, and then we can return to the question, what can we do about it? Why does it matter? Why should we worry about this? If you're on the upside of the gap, why should you worry about the kids on the downside of the gap? Now, partly you should, because it's just fundamentally unfair. It violates our core national values that kids don't have equal opportunity. But it's also economically bad for my grandchildren are going to do just fine. They're coming from well-educated homes, and they've gotten good schooling and you know, lots of good night moon and so on. But they will be worse off. My grandchildren will be worse off if we don't invest in poor kids, because the evidence is quite clear. Failing to invest adequately in the roughly 25 million poor kids in America costs the whole country over their lifetime about $5 trillion. And it's partly because of the increased cost for the criminal justice system if we don't give these kids the tools to do well in life. It's partly more than that, actually. It's because of the health costs. These kids, poor kids, are growing up in circumstances that mean they're going to get sicker earlier, longer, and worse because of their being growing up in poverty. But most important, there are a lot of smart kids who, if we gave them the tools, they could be making big contributions. There are a lot of really smart kids, you poor kids who are not going to go to college and not going to be able to contribute to the rest of the economy. So we're paying a serious price if we continue to allow this lower third of our kids to you know fall off the ladder.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what can we do about it? What's the action listeners might want to take?
Can I step back just for a minute and say we've been here before as a country? I'm answering your question, but I want to give this a little more historical perspective.
Yeah, sure. We've got the entire hour, so we can go on beyond past after we come back after a break. But go ahead, get us started. Go back to what? You're going back to an age that is akin to what we have right now in terms of the gaps?
Absolutely. It was about 100 years ago. It was called the Gilded Age. This was the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. That was the last time that the income gap and the social segregation was as big in America as it has become once again now. It was called the Gilded Age because there were a lot of robber barons who had a ton of money, and there were a lot of poor people, a lot of really desperate poor people in America around 1890, 1900. It had a lot of parallels to our current era. It was also a period of very high immigration, and that was causing some turbulence in the country. It was a period of great political corruption, in some respects worse political corruption than we have now, and certainly great political alienation and disgust well across the country. It was a period in which the public philosophy was what was called social Darwinism. Social Darwinism was a strange pseudoscientific theory that everybody would be better off if we were just selfish. The whole country would be better off if everybody was selfish. Mm-hmm. It was a nutty theory, and it, you know, isn't true, but it meant that it was encouraging people just to worry about themselves and not worry about other people or other people's kids. And the country was going to hell in a handbasket, frankly, in a way, as we are right now. There are a lot of parallels between that period in American history and our current period with these big, big social cleavages.
Bob Putnam, I have to cut you off. We're going to take a break and come back. We're on the edge of our seats here because you've taken us back to tie it into the Gilded Age. And we definitely want to find out how we removed ourselves from the inequality of that age. Perhaps there are lessons for us in the current, about our current situation. I have a feeling there are, Bob Putnam. Thank you for joining us this hour. We'll be back in just a minute. Bob Putnam, his latest book is called Our Kids. He identifies in it the widening opportunity gaps created by the growing inequality income among Americans. Bob Putnam, a well-known figure in the nation, around the world as a social scientist. He's at the Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. We'll be back with more of River to River and Bob Putnam in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guest this hour, Harvard political scientist Bob Putnam, his latest book, Our Kids. He identifies in this book some really worrying signs, trends that have been going on for decades that are now getting to the point where perhaps something has to be done. Bob Putnam certainly thinks that something has to be done. He's talking about the widening opportunity gaps created by the growing inequality among Americans, and specifically here, the implications for our kids and for all of us as society. Bob Putnam, it certainly sounds like the way you've been describing it, we're losing sort of what the essence of America is when we are very proud of the fact that we have a meritocracy of sorts where you can rise up from very meager means and become whatever you want to. And this is in danger, Bob.
Yeah, there's one of the most striking bits of evidence that we're not a meritocracy anymore comes from some studies that have been done. We've done some of these studies that ask, what's the likelihood of a kid completing college, getting a college degree, depending upon A, their own talents, and B, how much money their parents have? So kids who score high on tests and whose parents are wealthy are very likely to get a college degree. Let's call them smart, rich kids, and they're very likely to get a college degree. And kids who don't score well on tests and who come from poor backgrounds are very unlikely to graduate from college. Mm-hmm. The evidence shows that that the less able kids from rich backgrounds are more likely to graduate from college than the most able poor kids. And that just directly violates the idea of meritocracy. I'm not saying that kids coming from rich homes shouldn't go to graduate from college. I am saying that for sure the smartest poor kids ought to have at least as good a chance of completing college, and they don't. So it's not just about college costs, by the way. It's about all the other disadvantages that these kids have had to face, really, you know, beginning in the womb almost, but certainly from early in life, kids coming from poor backgrounds. That's what the book shows. Kids coming from poor backgrounds are handicapped at every stage in their life. So we don't have a meritocracy, and this growing gap between rich families and poor families has produced a growing gap between rich kids and poor kids. And as I was saying, this is not the first time that we've been in that predicament as a country. We faced a situation very much like this at the beginning of the 20th century, roughly 120 mm-hmm. years ago.
So how did we get out of that situation into a more equitable situation as a society by the middle of the 20th century, for sure? How did we get there?
It happened pretty quickly. The first thing is we began to notice the problem. And there were books written by, there was a famous book called How the Other Half Lives. And it was just a book of photographs and descriptions of what life was like in the slums of the Lower East Side of New York, intended to be read by the wealthy folks on the Upper East Side of New York. And essentially saying, look, this is what life is like in this country. Now, are you happy with that? And of course, some of the rich folks said, sure, why not? Let them eat cake or something. But enough of well-off Americans in that period said, we can't. That's not America. And they began to join with others to form a reform coalition in not only New York City but across the country. And this new book of mine, called Our Kids, has a lot of data in it because I'm a social scientist, but it also has a lot of mostly stories about rich kids and poor kids in towns and cities all across America. And that's not an accident. I don't mean that my book will have the same impact as How the Other Half Lives, but that's the genre in which it's written. It's designed to say to, you know, you and your listeners and you know, my family and friends and people across the country, look, have you realized how bad things have gotten for kids coming from poor homes? That's the first thing that happened back then. But the second thing that happened was there was a national debate about these problems in that era. That was, you know, we know about the so-called progressive era. That's Teddy Roosevelt and Jane Addams and other people having a national discussion. But the actual action, the real innovations that then turned out to fix the problem came from, you know, didn't come from Washington, didn't come from Cambridge, Mass. It came from Toledo and Galveston and Iowa, actually, all across America. People began to focus on the problem, this widening gap, and to get ideas about how it could be fixed here. And in fact, it was in places just like Iowa and Nebraska and Kansas where people had what turned out to be the best single idea then to fix the problem. And that idea turned out to be the invention of the high school. It was the first time in world history that any community had said, we ought to pay for all the kids in town to get a free secondary education. I know nowadays it seems so common, you can't imagine anybody had to invent that, but that idea came exactly from, as I say, from the Midwest, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, that kind of area, in small towns, and you have to imagine what was involved. You had to go to the rich banker or the rich farmer or the rich, you know, lawyer in town and say, well, your kids got a secondary education. You paid for them to go off to some private high school or some private secondary school, and they're now off in Chicago making money. But now you should pay higher taxes so that every kid in town should get a free secondary education. And that was a bit of a hard sell. But it turned out that decision, which, as I say, began in the Midwest and then spread quickly across the country, was the best decision Americans have ever made because it simultaneously did two things. It raised the average quality of the American workforce by a lot and made the American worker much more productive than the workers in any other country in America. Most of American economic growth during the whole of the 20th century came from that decision to give everybody a free secondary education. So everybody benefited from that, including the rich farmer and businessman and lawyer or banker, whatever, in town. And at the same time, it leveled the playing field. So it was a twofer. It meant we were both richer, the whole country was richer, and everybody had an equal chance. And that idea, as I say, that the reform, the national conversation, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and Jane Addams and the others, helped, but it helped. Eventually, these reforms were moved to the national level, but that came later. The first changes came from just ordinary folks trying to figure out how do we solve that problem, this class gap, you know, right here in Des Moines or in you know, some other small town in Iowa and or Ohio for that matter. And so that's what my image of today is, that this is a big problem nationwide. It's getting worse. We're moving toward a society that none of us have ever lived in which we have a hereditary, you know, upper middle class and a hereditary, poor class. And that's not an America that I think most Americans, if they think about it, will want to live in.
Okay, so is there, am I thinking about this in the wrong way when we say, okay, is there a point of no return? Are we on the cusp of something where we could regain what we've lost at point, whereas if we wait 10, 20 years, we're lost?
Well, you know, I don't want to, you know, as Yogi Berra said, prediction is hard, especially about the future. So I don't want to claim that I know that if we don't fix it by 2020, it's all over. That's not what I'm saying. I am saying I want to think more positively. This is something we can do. Now, we've got to talk about, we haven't talked about, what might be the equivalent of the high schools for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a discussion to have, and I'm happy to have that discussion. But my main point is to say, you know, I'm not trying to make America Sweden. I'm just trying to say we've done this before. This is a good American. We've gotten away from the idea that we're all in this together, but we can do this. Now, what does that mean practically? I've got some ideas. The last chapter of the book, Our Kids, lays out some ideas. I think, for example, that early childhood education, universal early childhood education, I mean getting kids professional, high-quality education beginning at 2, 3, or 4 years old, not waiting to kindergarten. We know that works. There's lots of good scientific evidence that works, that this works especially for kids coming from poorer backgrounds. It's got to be high quality. It can't be just sort of glorified babysitting. But interestingly, the best, most comprehensive early childhood education program at the state level across America is actually in Oklahoma, one of the reddest of states in America. So this is a purple problem in the sense that the coalition for fixing this problem, I hope, doesn't get torn apart by the political polarization we're in now. And I think we don't have to be. So early childhood education, I think, is a no-brainer, actually. But high quality, low quality, cheap early childhood education doesn't work, but high quality does. I think community colleges, there's a lot of opportunity there for improving the completion rate of community colleges and getting access to that, to community colleges, as a way of getting kids into good paying jobs that fit into the local economy. I think there are things we can do with respect to mentoring. The most important universal characteristic of poor kids today in America is that they're isolated and alone. They don't have good contacts with their parents because often their parents are split. They don't have good contacts, trustworthy contacts at school or church. There's a growing gap there. So I think there's plenty of opportunity for people to do serious mentoring. I don't mean just, you know, once a year having a lunch with some poor kid, but I mean being there in their lives and trying to help them get, you know, navigate. As I say, there are a lot of things we can do, and I really want to try to mobilize the creativity of people, you know, frankly, in Iowa to be in fixing it.
Bob Putnam is my guest this hour. Our Kids is his latest book. He's looking at the widening opportunity gaps created by the growing inequality among Americans. Bob, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to bring this into this election cycle. Of course, things were just months away from the first-in-the-nation test of our presidential candidates here in Iowa, the first-in-the-nation caucuses. I want to share with you this recent Quinnipiac University poll, because it bears on sort of the remedy here. If we are too partisan to even find a remedy, this is likely Republican caucus participants, Republicans, saying 70% to 25% that the federal government should not undertake efforts to reduce the income gap between wealthy Americans and the rest of the population. By comparison, on the Democratic side, 91% to 6% of Democrats, these are likely caucus goers, say the government should take measures to reduce inequality. What do you see in those numbers?
Well, I see an opportunity for some mutual learning. I note that the question there focuses on specifically on what the federal government should do. And as I said before, looking back at that earlier period in American history, I think we ought to begin these efforts to close these opportunity gaps at the state and local level. I think that partly because I think that the political deadlock in Washington is going to be hard to overcome in the short run. Look, you won't know this, but I actually live in New Hampshire. We're the other early primary state, and this issue is getting a lot of attention. This opportunity gap is getting a lot of attention as we go through the vetting of these candidates, various candidates in both parties. So I've thought a lot about that question of the role of this issue in this year's election. Look, when my team and I began this research project 4 or 5 years ago, our target at that time was, we said, let's see what we can do to contribute to making this issue, the opportunity gap, the central issue, central domestic issue in the American national elections of 2016. And at the time, it seemed like a silly aspiration, but I think that's going to happen actually now. I think this is going to be the most important domestic issue, and that's a big step forward, because it means we're focused on the problem.
By most important, you mean the issue which will decide the majority of votes?
Yeah, it's the issue, yes, exactly. The issue that will be most talked about in the debate. Look, and that's happening right now. I mean, well, let's begin with the current president, who said that this issue, the opportunity gap, is the most important challenge facing America. And he was almost literally quoted by Jeb Bush a couple of weeks ago when Jeb said, again, this opportunity gap, he was almost quoting from my book, actually, the opportunity gap is the most important challenge facing America today. And, you know, Hillary Clinton says she's running for president so that all kids in America have the same opportunities that her new granddaughter has. They're many Republicans, some of the most conservative Republican candidates, have been quoting me and my book on this subject. So I think it's not that I'm so important, but that the topic will be important and it'll be debated, and that's good. For my sins, I've actually spoken personally to many of the major candidates for president. They've come to me to talk about it, not because, you know, I'm a big campaign contributor, but just because they've heard that I know something about the issue and they want to figure out what to do about it. I do not think that we'll all have agreement on exactly what should be done. Of course not. This is a democracy with people with different views, and so that's what I think is going to happen. We are going to have a discussion about this. We're not going to lead to a consensus, so that, you know, I don't expect that on the first February in 2016 or 2017, I mean, the Congress will convene and they'll pass a national law saying there'll be equal opportunity, and we can dust our hands off and say, well, we've solved that one. Now let's turn to, I don't know, global warming or something. Right. That's not the way it's going to happen. That's not the way we do big social change in America.
Okay.
What is going to happen is we're going to have the national conversation, which is going to give oxygen to folks in towns and cities across America.
Also, with a huge bearing on recent elections and this upcoming election, the Citizens United decision of 2010. Please comment on that, the decision to remind everyone, saying basically it's okay for corporations and labor unions to spend as much as they want to convince people to vote for or against a candidate. Does this separate us from that earlier Gilded Age?
Absolutely not. They had exactly the same problem at that time, the problem of way too much money in elections. The Pennsylvania Railroad, which was a private corporation, owned the Pennsylvania State Legislature. They bought and paid for it all. No, I mean, you know, much. The irony is, in that earlier period, too, exactly like now, we had huge amounts of money rolling around in American politics that was desperately distorting priorities. And one of the things that era did, in fact, was to impose new restraints on campaign finance. The laws that have been overturned now recently by the Supreme Court, and I think those decisions are just terrible decisions to overturn these laws on campaign finance. Those laws were instituted 100 years ago. They were the very laws that the reformers 100 years ago put in place because they faced this big problem. So is campaign finance a problem? Absolutely. Is it something that we've got to address on the way to fixing other problems in America? Of course we do. But, you know, politics is not something that happens to you. Politics is something you do. And people in Iowa and people in New Hampshire know that. That's why we get so involved in these presidential campaigns. I'll give you an example. There's a group here in New Hampshire which has the name of Our Kids, New Hampshire. That is, they're focused on this opportunity gap in New Hampshire. This is a bipartisan group. It's a purple group. It's got a number of conservatives and a number of liberals in the group, people from business and labor and you know, the nonprofits and so on, people all of whom have decided that here in New Hampshire, we've got to fix our version of this problem. And this group is meeting publicly with each of the candidates when they come through here. Just as they're coming through Iowa now, they're coming through New Hampshire. And each of those candidates is being met by this group of bipartisan leaders in New Hampshire to say, tell me what you're going to do about the opportunity gap. And, of course, the different candidates are going to have different answers. I don't imagine that any of them is going to have a perfect solution to this. But that's a way of people at the grassroots in this state, and in your state, I would say, trying to pressure these candidates to focus on these real issues of inequality. And I think this is the kind of it's exactly states like yours and mine that can make a difference.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes left. I want you to address what has been a longstanding situation in voter turnout, namely that we have very low turnout among poor voters, and it's exactly these voters who should be most concerned with the trends that you've been describing. So do you see that changing, and not necessarily in our states, Iowa and New Hampshire, relatively affluent states, but in a general election situation?
That is a big challenge. It's a big challenge because these kids coming from poor backgrounds, the kids that we talked in that we describe and talk to in this book, our kids, we talk to these kids, and they are unbelievably cynical. Above all, they're cynical about politics. They're basically trying to see if they can get some kind of a job at Walmart or you know, someplace. These are really, really kids who are very poorly, in very desperate circumstances. Many of these kids are verging on homeless. And so the last thing they're worried about, maybe they should be more worried about politics, but they're not worried about politics. No, that, of course, I would like to have a greater equal participation politically by all Americans. Of course I would. But I think realistically, politics is not the top priority of these poor kids. They're desperately trying to survive. And it relies on the rest of us, and it's not just altruism. That's what I said before. My grandchildren are going to live in a less attractive America if we don't all do something about it. So what I'm trying to argue is this is not just a matter that ought to be of concern to the poor kids in America. Of course it should be, but it's in our interest, too, that we do more to help these kids thrive. The whole country will be better off. My grandchildren will be better off if we can help these kids to thrive.
Okay. Bob Putnam, we've run out of time. It's been wonderful spending the hour with you, political scientist, Malkin Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. Our Kids is the title of his 14th book. And this Friday, Putnam will be speaking at a sold-out event at Drake University's Harkin Institute. He'll also lead a coffee hour discussion about the growing inequality in American society on Friday morning. Bob Putnam, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks, Ben. It's good to talk with you and your listeners.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.